Yo, what's up, everybody? This is Will Dog from Ozo Motley. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
From the icy cold curves of Angeles Crest to the sunny shores of PCH, this is The Car Show, broadcasting this Saturday and every Saturday here on KPFK 90.7 FM for over 52 years. I am your humble host, Mark Vaughn of AutoWeek.com. I am joined this week and every week by the greatest co-host in the world, a practicing attorney specializing in automotive law, our Orange County Bureau Chief, Motor Press Guild member, and an owner of two Mazdas, Michelle Spencer. Welcome, Michelle.
Hey, Mark. Great to be here again with you to talk about cars.
And every week we are joined by a man whose resume is far too long to list here. Let's just do the highlights. It starts at Super Street and it ends right now where he is executive. Well, it doesn't end. It's still going strong. He is executive analyst at iccars.com. We call him Carl the Power Brower. Carl, welcome.
Hey, great to be on with you guys as always, although extra exciting this week given our guest.
That's right. This is not a typical show, folks. We're not going to do the calendar section, the news section, and the reviews section. All of that is thrown out the window because we have a very special guest, and I'm sure most of you know who he is and will love to hear his stories. He has got a whole bunch of them. Let's just dive right into it because I could not list that resume. It's even longer than Carl Brower's resume. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the car show, please. Pete Brock.
Woo!
Yay.
Hello, guys. How are you seeing, Mark?
It is always good.
Carl?
Always good to see you, Pete. Always good to hear from you. We have a whole long list of questions for you. What we'd like to do is kind of get the Pete Brock story compressed into 58 minutes. And we're going to go from Art Center to the Aero Vault in 58 minutes. So this is going to be a challenge. Some of our guests, it wouldn't be a challenge, you know, the one-dimensional ones, even the two-dimensional ones. But with you, this will be a challenge. Now, I get the first question here. And my first question to you, Pete, your first car was an MGTC. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mark.
Where did you find that? And how did you choose that one?
Well, you got to understand, that was like 1949. So this was the beginning of the whole sports car movement in the United States. And that was a considerably rare car at the time. And I happened to have a next door neighbor that had one. And I absolutely fell in love with the car, especially because he was actually racing the car. And I got to go with him to some of the races. I was like 12 years old at the time. And it was the most exciting thing that I could imagine.
And from that, you went to, I think, was it a Ford Falcon? Because it had more horsepower?
Well, no, I actually switched schools, and there were a bunch of guys there that were into hot rods at the time, not sports cars. It was just a different area. And I went into and I sold it, and I bought a 46 Ford. It was chopped, channeled, and sectioned. I put a Cadillac engine in it, and then I put two stripes over the front, just like the cars that had been taken to Le Mans for the very first American team. And that's where that look came from.
So that was your first car design.
It was actually. I didn't even know I was going to be a car designer at that time, or that there was even a job like that in the world. I wanted to be a race driver. That was all I wanted to do.
Did you win any races ever?
With that car? No, it was strictly a street machine.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go straight to car design then, because from there, you started in college. You started in engineering, I believe, before you went to Art Center. Why did you leave engineering?
Well, I thought that was sort of the direction to go, because I was in love with the automobile business and thought that was probably the wise thing to do, was get some engineering background. And when I got to college and found out that there was really nothing there that anybody understood anything about cars, I already knew more than any of the professors at that point. So I'd heard about the Art Center College of Design in Southern California and went down there. Now, you got to understand, at this time, you had to be 21 years old to be a race driver. And, you know, I was just 16 at that point. So I had a long time to figure out what I was going to do and how I was going to make enough money to be a race car driver, because all the guys that I was hanging out with at my first job in a garage where I was sweeping the floor and wiping up tools and stuff, they all would go racing. And that's all I ever wanted to do.
And yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later, because you eventually started teaching racing. But first, tell us about Art Center in those days. Is it true that there are a lot of legends around you? One legend is that you showed up without a portfolio, and
absolutely true. I went down there to discover what was the Art Center was about. I walked in the back door with the students and sat down at a couple of classes, and after about an hour or so of listening to what was going on, seeing what the guys were doing, put what was on the wall, I said, I've got to go to school here. So I walked up to the front office. And I said, okay, I want to go to school here. Where do I sign? And the nice lady said, well, you have to understand, this is a school for people who come back, who are already professionals. They come back to, refine their skills. And I said, yeah. Now, where do I sign? And she said, well, you'll have to bring in a portfolio. And there was a big silence. And I said, what's a portfolio? And so she, kindly explained what a portfolio was. And I said, well, I don't have one. She said, well, you'll have to bring in one, and then we'll, review it and determine whether you can come to school here. So I said, okay. So I went out in my car, sat down in my, three ring binder from school with little blue lines, and I drew hot rods for about 2 hours, and then walked back in just before they closed and said, here's my portfolio. I told her, hey, I'll just, I am not going away. I won't want to go to school here. And
it worked.
It worked. There's no way you could do that today. Today, you have to have a college education. You have to come in with a portfolio. There's so much talent out there that never gets fully realized or accepted because they don't understand what passion is. That's the first thing that you have to have, and the determination of what you want to do. And they allowed me in there, and I got as much help from the students as I did from the instructors there. It was a fabulous school. It still is. And I had, I don't think I've ever worked as hard in my life as I did there. I mean, it was every night until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning doing homework. And I loved it.
Were you studying under the great Strother McMinn?
I was. Strother was my number one mentor. And if it hadn't have been for Mac, I probably wouldn't even be here today. But he was such an incredible help.
Okay. And how did you get from, did you go to GM while you were still a student at Arts Center, or how did that transition happen?
Well, it's kind of a sideways story because, usually you don't go anywhere until after you graduated. And I only got about to the fifth semester. And at that point, my mother, who was financing my schooling at that point, said, okay, enough of this crap. You either go back to college or you don't get any more help here. And I said, well, I'm going to stay here, and this is what I want to do. And she says, well, in that case, you're on your own, and goodbye. We didn't speak for 7 years.
Oh, man.
And I looked around and realized, that I had already made some friends at GM, and I made a call back there. And I said, is there any chance that you could get me in as an intern? And the guy that had been coming out at that time was a guy named Chuck Jordan. He would eventually become the vice president of styling for General Motors. But I'd gotten to know Chuck over 2 semesters and told him, that my goal was to come back to GM and work for the Corvette program, because that was race cars, that was design, and that combination. So when I called him on the phone, he says, I'll have an airplane ticket for you tomorrow. Just go down to the airport and come back and see us. And I did. And they hired me at that point. I was 19, one of the youngest guys they'd ever hired. And that was the beginning of it. And it was, again, one of the greatest places I've ever worked from an educational standpoint, because I was surrounded by such incredible talent and people that were really, strong car guys. And, but again, the timing was just perfect, because Harley Earl, who had been the head of styling there for about 27 years, was just retiring at that point. And Bill Mitchell was going to take over as his right-hand man and had been there with him for, I guess, 24 years or so. And the other thing that was going on is that the entire Corvette program had been sort of canceled because there was a thing that was going on with all of the American manufacturers called the American Car Manufacturers Association. And they had been looking at what was being spent in racing, not in road racing like I was involved in, because in Detroit, nobody understood that at all. But if they looked at what they were spending at that time in NASCAR and in drag racing that was coming up, they were spending lots and lots of money. And I don't think they were as concerned about the money they were spending as the liability, because what was happening is that the engineers in each of these factories were all competing with each other at night with street races on Woodward Boulevard. And, of course, top management didn't really know about all this, and there were literally hundreds of people out there at night. And when this got to be such a big deal and it started hitting the press, they realized that if they had any problem with somebody crashing it, it could be tremendously bad. So by a mutual agreement, the American Manufacturers Association agreed that there would be no more racing and no more promotion of anything having to do with performance.
So did that kill the Corvette program, or what? How did that?
No, that was only a very, very small percentage of what was being done at that time. And so that sort of got killed off in it. But the interesting thing was, is that Bill Mitchell loved the Corvette, knew that it could be a great looking car, but had not had the chance yet to prove himself at what he wanted to do. So just at that time, he went over to the Turin show in Italy in 57 that summer and came back, and he saw in Turin a whole bunch of small streamliners. That was the current thing that was going on in Italy that time. Everybody was building them. Most of them were built out of 1600 cc Fiats, but they were building them also out of, you know, Alfa Romeos and such. But he saw one car there that really impressed him. That was the Alfa Romeo Disco Volante. And that Disco Volante, like all the rest of these cars, was a very nice sort of oval shape with a real crisp belt line all the way around and four little aerodynamic shapes over each tire. So each of the cars had been built there by Fiat or by Sanguilini or whoever, all had this theme. And he realized that that was a really accepted theme in Italy at that time, and came back with a bunch of photographs of all of those cars and wanted to get this Corvette program going. But he couldn't do it legally within the General Motors framework, because if he had gone up to the Chevrolet studio upstairs, GM management had already said no more Corvettes, we're getting out of the business and stuff. So
is it actually true that you guys were hidden away, sequestered in a basement, a secret basement room, to do the Corvette?
Well, that's where the young designers went, sort of as interns. We went down there and we worked on advanced concept. So Mitchell knew that advanced, you know, top management didn't go down to the studio, and he came down to see what was going on. And at first, you know, we walked in. We, of course, were absolutely blown away that the VP of design was coming in to talk to us as young designers there. And we didn't understand really what he was about. But he began to talk a little bit about, you know, what he was thinking about doing the new Corvette and stuff. And we're looking at each other, and he's telling us that maybe he's talking to us about designing a new Corvette. And then finally he said, "What do you guys know about our racing Corvette?" At that time, Zora Dunthoff had built a car called the SS Corvette. And it had been entirely secret within General Motors. Nobody was supposed to know anything about it. And, of course, if you were really interested in racing or whatever, you happened to learn really what was going on. And we knew that that car was going to go down to Sebring in 1957 and be raced. So myself and a couple of the guys, we got in a couple of Fuelies, drove all the way down to Sebring to watch the SS Corvette run down there. So anyway, to make a long story short, I told Mitchell about the fact that we'd gone down to Sebring to see that car, and that was really what we loved the most about General Motors. at that point, he really lit up and understood that he had a group of guys he could work with.
He had the right guys. Yeah. Hey, yep. Carl had a couple of questions for you about that car. Carl, what did you think? What was your question?
Well, you kind of already answered one, Pete, with kind of the genesis of where Bill Mitchell had seen those Italian Screamliners that kind of inspired it. I think it's the C2 and the 63 Corvette and all still one of my favorite designs from the history of Corvette. And
it was really my first slot car, Pete. Did you know that? It was my first slot car.
You had very good
taste. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's just it's a classic design. And I still see when I see those cars advertised, you know, I've never even driven, let alone owned a 63 or a C2 era Corvette. Yep. But I still consider them one of the most graceful and timeless designs in American car history, for sure.
Well, that's the car that made Bill Mitchell's name at General Motors. I mean, of course, he had a lot of power there. But understand that he had to do this project in secret. And when we got the car designed, Bill downstairs, go backward a little bit. After he came in and understood that this is what he wanted to do, he took out a bunch of photographs that he'd taken at the show in Turin and explained that was a theme that he wanted to do and do a new Corvette. And he said, okay, you guys, put your best work up on the wall and I'll be back in a couple of days and we'll talk a little bit more. So when he came back, you know, he walked around the room, looked at all the work that all of us had put up on the wall and he picked one sketch off the wall. He said, who did this? And I raised my hand and he said, okay, talking to the rest of the guys, he says, now your job is to do something even better than this. I want you guys to really reach and I'll be back in a couple of days and we'll do it again. He didn't ask my name or anything. He just generally said what he wanted to do with the direction. He was pleased that we had followed his direction. You understand, as a chief designer, Bill Mitchell never touches the pencil. He just tells his designers what to do. So he was pleased with what had seen, and he came back a few days later. And again, we had all our new work up on the wall, and he did the same thing. He walked around the wall and picked off another sketch off the wall. Who did this? I raised my hand. He said, okay, you're going to lead this project here and going to be the lead designer on this, and I want you to work with the rest of the guys and just expand on this theme. So we worked on it. Now, this is November of 1957, Mark. You know, the car didn't come out until 63. The reason for that is there was so much resistance within management at General Motors at that time to even think about building a new car, much less a sports car, which was totally, you know, what they didn't want to do. But he agreed that they agreed to sort of let him go. But he said, if you want to continue with this project, you cannot put the Corvette name on it. You cannot put the Chevrolet name on it, and you'll have to pay for it yourself. And he said, okay, I'll do that. So out of his own pocket, you know, he paid for us to finish that car, which was extremely expensive.
Yeah, that would never happen nowadays, would it?
Oh, I mean, he was just an amazing guy. But anyway, because he loved deep sea fishing and everything, and he loved the shape of things going, he called the car the Stingray. So that name appeared before the Chevrolet name or the Corvette name appeared. But when we finally got the car done and we took it to the very first race, he took it as a privateer guy, and a couple of guys in the shop went along with him as his team. You know, he was just like, you know, on his private trailer, went there. And of course the press knew who Mitchell was, and that car showed up, and it absolutely blew the world away. There were so many people handing him checks that everybody wanted to have that car. So when he came back to management, it convinced him that there really was going to be a market for the Corvette. And that's really how it started. If it hadn't
People are still handing checks for Corvettes. So started.
It's crazy. That car was earth shattering in 63. Can you imagine if they'd gotten, you know, off their butts and that thing had come out in 59 or 60? I mean, it would have just been that much crazier for it to be 3 or 4 years earlier than it actually came out when it could have come out. Pete, that's amazing. Sorry, Michelle. Well, go ahead.
It still looks good on the street today. I mean, you drive one around today and it's people are still you know, are so impressed with it. You know, it's just incredible, you know.
Split window and all. Michelle had a question. Michelle?
That was the question, was did you intend for it to be a split window? And were you aware that they were only going to allow that for 1 year and those kind of things? Tell us about that.
Because those are electrical items. I had designed the car, you know, it didn't have the split window in it. And Mitchell came in one morning and looking it over and everything. And he said to the clay model, he says, I want you to take a knife and run a line right down the middle of the back window. Okay, so the clay modeler goes over there and puts that line down there. And he says, okay, now divide that into a little thin strip down there and make two windows and model that. And let me take a look at it. So as he was doing this, he was explaining why he was doing it. He said, you know, one of my all-time favorite designs was the 57 SC Atlantique Bugatti that had a split down the middle. And that's where the split window came from. And we understood immediately that it was an homage to a famous car, and Mitchell wanted to do it, so that was going to be his signature on it. Of course, what happened is that over in engineering, Zora Duntoff heard about this and came over to see what was going on, and he absolutely blew up. He said, there is no way that we're going to have this, you know, window split, because you're not going to be able to see out the back of it. And Mitchell said, you know, your job is to, you know, worry about doing the chassis and stuff over there, leave styling to me. So it got literally into a big shouting match whether they were going to have this or not.
Oh, that's great. That's always good when there's a shouting match in the styling studio. There's one of your projects, a fairly recent project, is the book that you wrote about the Corvette Stingray. And that book is a beautiful book, and people can buy it now. Is that correct?
Say yes.
So your book on the Corvette Stingray is still available and still out right now, right?
Absolutely. It gives you the whole history on it, especially the whole story about the split window in the back end and how that got accepted. But you got to understand, at this huge, you know, management, you know, war that was going on, these two top guys screaming at each other, whether or not how it was going to have the split window or not. Finally, it was resolved that they both went in to see Ed Cole, who at that time was the president of Chevrolet and, of course, had been responsible for designing the new small block and everything. And he sat him down and he said, okay, Bill, you want the split window, and Zora, you want the open window. He said, Bill, you get your split window, but just for 1 year, and the next year we go to the open window. Not because it was better one way or another, but because it was less expensive to do. So that was the cost to go back.
Now we know. Well, from that, Pete, the next item on your extraordinary resume, you went to Shelby American during what is really the golden era of Shelby American. How did you make the transition from General Motors styling to Shelby American in Southern California?
Well, you got to understand that I just turned 21, and my goal, of course, was to go racing. And I bought myself an old race car to rebuild, and I wanted to go back to California and go racing, because there's no racing going on in the Detroit area. You know, everything that was happening was in Southern California. So I towed my Cooper Climax back to California, and I went to my first race at Palm Springs in 1959. And I just happened to park in a spot, and the guy that pulled in next to me was a guy named Max Balchowski, and Max changed my life. And just an incredible guy.
Now, that's Max Balchowski of Old Yeller fame, right?
Absolutely. So Max, of course, was the blue-collar hero of Southern California and the Cal Club racing scene. You know, for one of the very first guys to run V8 engines in his own chassis and competing against all the big money guys like John Edgar and stuff, who had big trailers with Maseratis and Ferraris and everything, with all the top drivers. But Max's Old Yeller was a very, very competitive, and he was a brilliant, brilliant designer, but managed to do everything on a very, very simple scale for very little money. The thing was that he was so intelligent, understanding what made race cars successful and how to tune them. And so I ended up working for Max in his shop, basically as a gopher, chasing parts for him during the day and exchange He would help me work on my car at night. This is 1959. If you know what happened in 1959, there's a guy named Carroll Shelby who just happened to be the co-driving winner at Le Mans in 1959 and was deciding that he was going to quit racing because he had a bad heart and came back to California because that's where the center of everything that was going on, went in to talk to Max and said, would you allow me to run your car for the last couple of races of the season? I'm going to retire, but I'd like to go out, you know, running some good stuff. So they made an agreement to do that. So during that period when he came and went, you know, with Max on that thing, I got to know Carroll pretty well. And he told me about his plans long term, that he wanted to build his own new sports car, which sounded, you know, just so beyond possible because he didn't have a nickel to spend, really. But what he did want to do is he wanted to do a driving school. And long story short, he asked me to run the driving school for him. And that's where I started to really get some track time on it. And at that time, the Cobra program, developed. And I ended up doing most of the development driving on that car at the very beginning.
So they just, you started out sweeping floors for Max Balchowski. That led to meet Carroll Shelby. And that led to you drawing and designing the Cobra Daytona Coupe.
Yes. Among other things that I did for Shelby. Basically, you understand that I never told Shelby that I was a car designer. I wanted him to only know that all I wanted to do was drive race cars. And, of course, that I'd done all the testing on the Cobra Forum out at Riverside because I'd been there with the school. So that combination of being at the track every day and then on the off days teaching school and driving on the track, I knew it very well. And so he had a couple other guys come out to test, among them Dan Gurney and Bill Krause. And I was right there with him, of course. And I thought for sure that I was going to get that ride because I was very, very quick. Dan was really a couple of tenths quicker, but I was faster than Billy. But, you know, he ended up taking Billy Krause instead of me. And I'll tell you, I was really upset at the time. I thought that I'd gotten my ride taken away. And of course, he did the smart thing. You know, I think I had maybe 7 races at that time on my license. And of course, Billy was the top guy. He'd been running midgets. He'd been running dirt cars. He'd been running sports cars. He even had a D-Jag with a Chevy in it and stuff. So he was really the right guy that he chose. And so as soon as Billy got in the car and then we ran him the very first time in October of 62 against the brand new Corvettes, and he just disappeared on the track until it broke the rear subaxle. But everybody saw how successful the Cobra was going to be. And so the next morning, you know, every top driver in the country was calling Carroll to see if he could get a seat in that car. And that included Ken Miles, Bob Bondurant, Dan Gurney, Dave McDonald. You know, so right then he had his choice of all the top drivers at that point, and there was no way I was going to get that ride. But
that's a bummer, man. You could have been Dan Gurney.
Yep, could have.
Carl had a question about the Cobra Daytona Coupe. Carl, what was your question?
Well, I was curious, Pete, because obviously it was engineered so that the thing would stay on the ground at the high speeds that you reached at tracks like Le Mans. I was curious, was there ever any discussion of making the Cobra Coupe a production car, like the open top version? Was it just like, you know, this makes sense for racing, but we don't want to deal with trying to make it, sell it to the public? Or did no one ever even think about it? You know, what kept that car from being a higher volume vehicle?
Well, the long story on that is that it was so successful that Ford Motor Company looked at why it was successful. And it was these guys that were running this little funny car out in California called the Cobra. So they hired Shelby to run the car that they were developing called the GT40, which was doing miserably at that time, had not got on. So when Ford hired Shelby, that was the end of the Cobra program. Unfortunately, it could have been very, very successful. But even so, we loaned the car to a privateer team over in England, and they went on to win the world championship with it. But even that first year, when we ran the car, we were the fastest car on every track that we ran that year. We set the qualifying top speed. We didn't win every race. We had some problems. But we were very, very fast, and obviously the car would have been a winner had we gone that way. But Ford wanted to focus completely on the GT40. So that's what happened. And we loaned the cars that we had built. We built six of them. Those were loaned to the Alan Mann team in England, who ran them in 1965 as a privateer team. And so won the world championship. It was like shooting fish in a barrel that year, because at the end of 64, Enzo Ferrari announced that he was going to quit running in the GT class. There was no way that he could beat us after having in a row.
Yeah, you scared him off.
Yep, absolutely. So
that's fabulous. Well, that's really impressive, Pete. I honestly knew, obviously, it won. I did not know it basically won in spite of Ford's help, not because of Ford's help. Ford distracted you guys away from further developing it, and it took privateers without Ford caring at all one way or the other to still go out and win with it. So I had no idea about that. That's very amazing.
Huh. Yeah, it was, and Alan did a fabulous thing on it. It was interesting to notice what happened at the end of the 64 season or 65 season, after we won the last races. We essentially won the championship. All the cars were brought back to shop in the UK. And at that point, the tax man came in from England and explained to him. He said, you brought these cars in under bond, and they'll have to be either the tax will be paid on them if you're going to keep them here, or they'll have to be sent back to the United States, where they came from. And of course, by that time, Ford had taken over at Shelby's, and there was nobody at Shelby's operation that knew anything about what was going on with these Cobras over in England. So there was all these telexes going back and forth, begging to send the money over, and please, let's get, And finally, the tax man came over to Alan Mann and said, look, if you don't have these cars out of here by, 2 weeks or whatever it is, we're coming back. We're going to put the cars on a big van. We're going to haul them out, and we're going to dump them all in the North Sea.
That's how they do things. That's how the tax people do things.
Wow.
He couldn't get any answer at all from Shelby, from Ford. Nobody cared about the project or what was going on. Alan Mann paid for it out of his own pocket to send the cars back to the United States rather than see them destroyed.
That's a lot of passion in these things. Bill Mitchell and Alan Mann and everybody. I understand right now there is a version of the Cobra Daytona Coupe that has a couple of finishing touches that you did not have time to put on the original one, and that you can buy the sort of the Pete Brock director's cut of the car. Is that the case?
Yeah, the fully evolved version.
That car is made by a Superformance in South Africa and distributed here in the United States by Superformance. We've made about a little over 300 of those now, and they are fabulous, fabulous car. I mean, I've got one myself, and I've had it now for about 8 years, and it's just a great, great automobile,
That's a lot of there's so many cool things.
That's the one.
Yes?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the one. I've been to Superformance several times. I know all the guys over there, and I hear those guys all say, this is the one. They're like, the GT40s are cool and interesting, but they're kind of a bear to like drive in the real street. They say that the Daytona Coupe is very functional, daily drivable car, which to me is fascinating and very tempting.
Well, it has all of the modern suspension. The same guy that designed all the good suspension stuff on the GT40 applied all of that modern suspension design, brakes, and everything that went under this new Daytona. So underneath the car is completely modern, and you buy it as a roller because it can't come into the country as a completed automobile at this time. So you have a choice of running whatever engine you wanted. I run a Chevy engine in mine, which, a lot of the Ford guys look at it and think that's,
Well, you worked at Chevy, so
you've got a history there. You can have a Chevy engine.
You can get away with that. All right. Well, there's so much to your life, Pete. If you were more boring, this would be an interesting, shorter interview, but you're just too darn fascinating. Let's jump right ahead. At some point, you left Shelby and you started your own race team. Tell us about that.
Well, it was very interesting because I had a chance to work with some of the very first Japanese cars that were offered in the United States. I actually started with a small company called Hino, and I was hoping because Toyota ended up buying Hino, and they had offered me the contract to run the new 2000 GTs for them, which was a fabulous automobile. And so I signed a contract to run that car for them for the 68 season, I think it was. And it turned out that Carol had learned what was going on and went down there. Actually, his accountant had told him he had, of course, just been had quit with Ford Motor Company after they won Le Mans and had the shop all open, nothing going with Ford. And his accountant said, you know, what you should do is buy a Toyota dealership. So he sent his accountant down there and they made a deal of, you know, maybe buy a Toyota dealership. So he went down there personally, and when he was talking, he mentioned, he said, have you guys ever gone racing? And they, of course, said, well, we just signed a contract with Pete Brock to run all cars. And, of course, Carroll was at the peak of his fame at this time, you know, after just winning the Le Mans in 1966. And I'm sure management just looked at the choice and said, we can have Carroll Shelby build our cars or this guy from California that nobody's ever heard of. And they actually took the cars and secretly gave them to Shelby, even though I had a signed contract, and I lost the deal. So I didn't learn about it until one of the guys in the shop called and said, you know, you think you're going to get those cars, but they're here and we're working on them. So I figured out that Carol had kind of snookered me at that point. So I went down to really just absolutely cold, went down to Nissan and walked in the door asking him, you know, who runs your racing program? And they didn't even have a racing program at that point, you know. And so I, you know, sort of talked to everybody, and they basically said, just go away. We're not interested. We don't have a car that's going to be competitive or whatever. So I went back to the people I'd been working with in Japan, Mr. Miyako at the Hino factory, and said, what shall I do? And we worked together now for 3 years. I'd been very successful with his cars. And we'd run and actually started the car called Hino Contessa, which I'd won a race with at Riverside. And it looked like we were going to begin to, you know, selling those cars in the United States. And then Toyota ends up buying them. So
how did you went back to Datsun after that?
Well, what happened is I talked to him and gave him my problem. He said, I know somebody at Nissan. Let me call you in a couple of days. He called back about 3 days later and said, it's all set. You're going to get the cars and the budget you want to run the cars. I said, how did you do that? And he said, well, my friend at Nissan is the chairman of the board. And I told him of our relationship for 3 years. And on that basis, he made the deal. But he said, you cannot tell anybody where the money came from or where the cars came from, because that would be upsetting to the people in the United States. So we showed up the first year. Nobody even knew who we were, running as privateers, won the Pacific Coast Championship, qualified for the ARC for the national championship. And at that point, Mr. Katayama discovered what was going on and asked for me to come down. And I met Mr. Katayama. And from that point on, we started running the 240Zs. And we won two national championships with that car. And at that point, I told him, look, there's no point in us continuing to run the 240Zs for you. We give all the information out to the privateer teams. They can continue to run. They're running against the Porsche factory teams. They're running against the Triumph factory teams. And at that point, he said, well, what should we do? And I said, we should run the 510 Datsun. And he was absolutely aghast. He said, that's our economy car. And I said, that's the point. That's the car that will make you if we can do it. And we did. We took over the 510 program, running against the factory-backed Alfa Romeos and BMWs. And it just changed the whole Japanese car market at that point, and really was the beginning of the tuner market, because you could buy that car for around $3,000, put a little bit of money into it, and be a winner right away.
So if you trace the history of the Fast and Furious franchise, it goes back to Pete Brock in Gardena.
Yeah, it does. And I had no idea. I knew he was a great designer. I didn't know he was also good at making corporate decisions that helped launch automakers in the U.S. And, that's pretty impressive.
And you engineered those suspensions on the BRA 510s, right?
Oh, not me. I had Trevor Harris, who I feel was the best American designer, and still is. Trevor worked for me. I'm part of our crew. He reworked our suspension for us and figured out how to make all that stuff work. You know, I just hired the best guys that I had that I knew, a lot of them that had been friends of mine at Shelby's. And with that group of guys, we were really unbeatable. You know?
Yeah. One of your drivers was John Morton, of course. And he was also, he had raced at Shelby. So did you have trouble getting John Morton to drive the 510s?
All I had to do was tell John, listen, I want you to come over to work for me as a fabricator. And he says, I'll do it, but I want to drive one of your cars. And of course, the only way I would have gone with it, him driving, because he was so good. But I hired John, and he became, you know, four-time national championship with us and unbeatable, fabulous guy. We're still friends, and he's still as fast as he was, you know, and amazing guy. Been just a great, great relationship with all the guys that work for us. You know, it's an amazing team.
Yeah. How long did the BRE team, how long were they in it? I know you won Trans Am under 2.5 liter class twice, I think. And how long did the team last?
Okay. It's really about 2.5 years. We ran, you know, primarily 71, 72 with those cars, and winning the two national championships with the first years with the 240Zs, and then overlapping, we were running both Trans Am and 240Zs in the last year when we run the 2.5 Trans Am championship. And the problem here was we were so successful that we won 80% of our races that finally the Alfa Romeo and BMW guys quit, said we can't even compete anymore, so they quit, and that was the end of the series. But what it did really do is it put Trans Am racing on the map, because prior to that point, there had been no sedan racing until we began racing sedans with the Cal Club in Southern California.
And those cars are still around, right? Your race cars, they're all accounted for, I think, aren't they?
Every one of them. Yep. All the Daytonas are accounted for. There's only three left in the United States. One's in Germany, one's in Japan, and one's in Argentina. The other three are here. And then, of course, all of the Datsuns are still under collector garages at this point. So they've all been saved. They're all fabulous automobiles, you know.
How was it running a race team? Is that the kind of thing that's profitable? I mean, you made a living doing that, or did you have other things going? What was that like?
You couldn't survive without factory backing at that point. You have to remember that you know, this is supposed to be amateur racing at this point with the SCCA at that point when we began, that there's not supposed to be any money paid to drivers. It's, you know, it's supposed to be all straight up. But you've got to understand that with the United States divided into several regions, each region has only its top three cars that can go to the national champion runoffs. So in each region that's important, you have Porsche sponsoring their team there. One on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. Same thing with Triumph. They had one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. And even Porsche had one out of Kansas City. So when you go to the national championships, you have the top drivers from all over the United States with factory backing. So we, of course, had factory backing from Nissan. We had support from Goodyear and some of the other smaller people that were on our team, like Simon Eyes, Bactus, and we did very well.
Okay. Again, so much to cover here. If everybody's okay, I just want to say, I remember the hang gliders. You guys were on bus stop benches around the South Bay. I remember seeing those, and you had like backpacks. The coolest kids in junior high school had the up backpacks. How do you make a transition from a successful race team to selling airplanes, making and selling airplanes?
Well, you got to understand, our shop was in El Segundo, which was just a few blocks from the beach, Playa del Rey Beach. And it so happened that they were building a brand new power plant just on the south end of the LAX runway. And to make the foundation for that power plant, they had to dig up a huge amount of sand, and they made this gigantic sand dune that was a couple hundred feet high. And at that point, there were a bunch of hippies there that had discovered the Mechanics Illustrated or Popular Science plans on how to build a hang glider. And they were making hang gliders out of bamboo, you know, visqueen plastic and duct tape and stuff, and flying them off of this this thing. So if you made a really great flight, you could fly almost 100 yards down to the ocean. So I had, you know, driven out of the shop one day and saw all these kids running up and down the hill on with these gliders and stuff. And I went over and I was really impressed. And finally, one of the guys said, "Hey, you know, you want to try this?" And I said, "Sure." He explained what was going on and how to launch the glider, and hooked me in. And I took off, and I had this perfect flight all the way down the beach. But the thing is, for a few seconds, I was airborne, and it changed my life. I said, "I have got to do this. This is more fun than anything else I've ever done." And it really literally cost nothing to do it. So I went back to the shop, figured out how to make a better hang glider instead of bamboo. I had aluminum tubing, changed over to the good stainless steel fittings and everything. So I actually made up a little kit to build these. And I went back out to the beach and showed it to all these hippies about how they could improve their gliders. And they were really excited about it. So I showed them, you know, we have these little tangs, all these things. And they said, "Well, yeah, we want to have that." And I said, "Well, it's a little kit. You can have it. How much?" "This is $5, you know, for the little parts." "What a ripoff!" Boy, everything had been for free at that point. So I went back, finished up the glider with all of my stuff, came out and showed them how much superior it was. And the next day I sold a lot of parts, and we began the biggest hang glider company in the world. And it went from there for several years. So from running it just off the sand dunes on Playa del Rey, we were going out to Lake Elsinore and flying off 1,000 feet out there. And that's when we discovered thermals, that we could stay in the air. And we began to climb and climb and climb. And pretty soon we were going, you know, 50 miles, 70 miles, 100 miles, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet. And the whole sport just took off. And finally, we ended up with the world championships up in the Owens Valley. And that lasts for a week up there with all these contests. And it, as it turned out, my company at that point, UP, we won the world championship 6 years in a row. And we were at that point, we were flying at 12 to 15,000 feet. And our goal was at 300 miles. So it it just changed the sport. And it was so exciting. And it's still probably one of the most wonderful, beautiful, exciting things that I've ever done.
And that sand dune is still there, and you can still go down there, and I think you can rent a hang glider and go for a little flight. Did you use all that aerodynamic knowledge that you gained there when you made the AeroVault? Because tell us about AeroVault. This is, of course, your trailer company now. Right. The things are stable. They're lightweight. They fit your race car. Tell us how you went from making hang gliders to making trailers.
Well, I've always been interested in aerodynamics. I mean, that's the thing that made the Daytona successful and made our race car successful to a certain extent. So when I got together to build the first production Daytonas down in South Africa, and the car came back, I had to have a trailer to transport it around. And I went around and I looked at all the trailer manufacturers and I said, "This is absolutely absurd. Everything is square. You know, that there's so much drag towing these things, you get to 50 miles an hour, you know, you're going to kill yourself." So I designed the new trailer just for myself so I could haul my car around. And as soon as we got it done, we had people asking, "Where can they duplicate? Where can we duplicate it?" So we began to expand it and make a few more. And that's what we've ended up doing. It's been very, very successful for us.
Did that trailer get time in the wind tunnel?
No, everything. I've never had that kind of money for wind tunnels and stuff, but I knew what worked. And the most important thing, for example, is it's fully skinned underneath. You know, if you look at most trailers, there's all kinds of, you know, rough stuff underneath and backs, axles and whatever. But I had learned from talking to an aerodynamicist at Chrysler who had designed the Superbirds for him he was working at that time on the new, the first new vans that were being done by Chrysler. And I said to John, I said, you know, after doing the Superbirds, it must be kind of boring to work on these vans. And he said, no, it's quite a challenge. And I said, well, what's the most important thing to know about that? He says, well, the most drag on this trailer is the rear axle underneath, because there were front drive, you know, and there was a solid axle underneath hanging down. And he says, that's the most amount of drag on this thing. So when we went to build a trailer, the first thing I did was cover up all the axles and smooth it all out. And consequently, we have a trailer that's built like a race car, has super lightweight, is aerodynamic, and is probably 15 to 20% more efficient than everything else out on the market.
So it's race cars transporting race cars.
Yeah. Or your hang glider.
Or a hang glider.
Yeah, you put your hang glider inside it. You know, you could just tape the pieces of yarn all over the outside. You don't need to have expensive wind tunnel time, rolling road wind tunnel. Just tape yarn all over the outside and videotape it as you go down Interstate 15 there.
Well, we did that. And of course, it worked out very, very successfully. That's very, very still a good way to look at things. But now, of course, everybody has all these expensive, programs that they do on a computer, and millions of dollars were spent that way, you know. So
how can people, if people wanted to buy an AeroVault trailer or buy one of your books, where can they reach you?
Okay. Well, you can do that very easily. All they have to do is go to AeroVault.com and you can get all the information, or you can go to our VRE website and get, you know, all the history on our books and
what's the name of the VRE website?
So we have VRE. Two different numbers, you know. The best one is VRELegacy.com.
Okay. All right, good. And if somebody buys an AeroVault trailer, do they get a Pete Brock signature somewhere on it?
Absolutely. Everyone has the special tag on it with my signature personally.
Oh, that's very nice. Carl, don't you need one? Michelle, you need one for your Miata.
I do.
All the Miata. Fantastic.
Talk about
how many different versions are there, Pete? Like, do you have one standard size or do you have multiple sizes?
Well, yes. You know, we started out with a single size, but we now make five sizes because we actually have three different lengths and two different heights, so we can combine those basically with the same structure on it. But, you know, we started out simply making the first one simply size of a Cobra, but we had more people, of course, that went and put big American cars in them, and then all the hot rod guys came along, and a lot of them were, you know, earlier cars and stuff, so we started working with people with the old classics, you know, Bentleys and that sort of thing. But our number one sales go to Porsche owners. 60% of the BRE trailers is sold to Porsche people. They understand it. They understand the lightweight. They understand the quality, and they understand the aero. And that's really where our main market is.
And what percentage demand the Pete Brock signature on their trailer? 100%, I would imagine.
All of them.
Because that's what I would do if I ever got a race car and if I ever got a trailer and got a truck to tow it.
What's the weight?
Has the sign black on it personally.
What's the weight of these trailers? You know, I have not got a lot of experience.
2340, you know.
Wow, that's good. Okay.
Yeah. How much is it? I missed that.
2340.
That's pretty lightweight.
That's
significantly lighter than a typical, I won't name any other brand names, but typical race car trailer, right?
Well, the main thing is it, instead of having to have a big, you know, F-350 or big Ram truck or something to tow it, you can tow it with your SUV. So your daily driver is as great a tow car as out there. So it's very, very inexpensive once you've got one to tow one. And you can have a daily driver and a tow car at the same time because the lightweight allows you to do that.
Yeah. All right. We've only got, Michelle, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Pete. I wanted to ask about your other book. The one about Road to Modena. What's that book about?
Well, that was a great, great era that I had a chance to go over and work with Alejandro Di Tommaso, At that point, the Ford had not yet assigned their full GT40 program to Carroll, and we were just beginning to run cars in what would become the Can-Am class. We'd been running Coopers with Ford Cobra engines in them. They were called King Cobras, and we were very successful with them. But we could see what was happening. Everybody was going to switch over to 7-liter engines. McLaren was going in that direction. So Carroll called up Alessandro in Italy and said, listen, could you build a new 7-liter motor out of our Cobras? And he said, of course, I can do that. That was what he specialized in doing, that sort of engineering. And we'd like to, do our own body. So I had actually designed a new body for one of our top drivers, Dave McDonald, as a King Cobra. And his two crew chiefs didn't like the design I did. It seemed too complicated because it had a movable wing on the back end and some aerodynamic things. So I ended up taking that design with me when I went over to Italy to Di Tommaso. And he had built six chassis. The plan was going to build six new Di Tommaso Shelbys with this 7-liter motor and this the new body on it, which is called the P70. And we got about halfway through that program, just about got it all finished up. And Ford announced that they were going to give the GT40 program to Carroll. And one of the clauses in that contract was no more cars of anything else. He had to work strictly on the GT40 program. So that was the end of the Di Tommaso program. And it turned out, that Di Tommaso took the program back. It was the star of the Turin show in 65, but he had five other chassis, and he ended up working with Giugiaro, and they built the Mangusta on the other chassis, and that was a very successful program.
It's just fascinating, the spider web of intrigue behind all these great cars, and I've seen that that one car. I think you made, we've got a minute and a half left.
Well, Michelle, you asked about that. There's a chapter on each one of those things in that book, and that's why it's called The Road to Modena, because of all these things I'd worked on.
Of course.
And got over to work with Di Tommaso, and that was sort of the last thing I got to do there,
Yeah, that's great. That's a fascinating life, Pete. We have 1 minute left. What are you working on now?
Oh, I'm having a fun project. I am building a car that we would have raced in 1969 had we continued on it with Shelby's with the Daytona program, except, as you know, after Ford won in 1966, 1, 2, 3 at Le Mans, they changed the rules in 68 that only cars, no more big American V8s, everything had to be a 3-liter engine. So I'm working with some private guys, and we're working on a 3-liter V8 engine Cobra Coupe.
That sounds like fun. Ooh, I can't wait to see that. Looking forward to that. Can't thank you enough. Pete and Gail Brock, ladies and gentlemen, motorsports legend right here on the Car Show. Thank you, Michelle and Carl, as always, for being on the show. Be sure and check out Pete Brock's books. And everybody go out and buy an AeroVault trailer, okay? For the sake of your race car, buy two of them. Give one to Carl for his Porsches.
Yes.
Stick around for the next show is Rhapsody in Black. 2 hours of great music that sounds great in your car audio. And I and Michelle and Carl will be back with you next week on the Car Show.
Black August is a month-long commemoration dedicated to honoring Black freedom fighters and political prisoners, particularly those that have been killed or imprisoned due to their activism and resistance against systemic oppression. It originated in the 1970s within California prisons and has since spread to communities, becoming a time for reflection, study, and recommitment to the fight for Black liberation. KPFK Radio stands in solidarity with Black August, which serves as a reminder of the ongoing struggle for Black liberation and the importance of honoring those who have fought for freedom, past, present, and future.
Support comes from Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum, presenting outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages this June through October 2025. Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with Much Ado About Nothing, Strife, The Seagull Malibu, Wine in the Wilderness, and a world premiere, Echoes of the New World. The Theatricum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show.